Good morning, everyone. Here is the latest news reported direct by our correspondents all over the world. First, for a summary of all developments up to the moment, we take you to Edward Deuce in London.
This is London. Thick black smoke, like a ribbon of mourning, drifted over the city of Toulon this morning from what only 24 hours ago was one of the world's great naval bases. All through the night, at intervals, blasts rocked the houses in a radius of 5 miles. Fires raging on the half-submerged capital ships and heavy cruisers reached the magazines, and these then blew up with terrific roars. In a sense, the blasts were the last salute to what was once the fourth largest navy in the world. Interspersing these intermittent roars, smaller ammunition dumps on land blew up. Time fuses had probably been laid in them. Otherwise, the city was reported quiet. The French people were too shaken to stop to think. It was the most terrific blow the French people have yet suffered. In London, officers and men of the fighting French Navy lined up in the courtyard of the French Admiralty and observed 1 minute silence in memory of the men and ships who died. The tricolor flew at half-mast from all the fighting French buildings and all fighting French warships in waters all over the world. At Portsmouth Naval Base, the French crews stood on deck in a minute's silence while a salute was fired. The Vichy radio announced that the Germans had ordered the complete evacuation of the military aerodrome of East near Marseille. The Germans have taken over all the military and civil services and have occupied the principal buildings on the aerodrome. An official broadcast announcement claimed that when Marshal Pétain heard that the Germans were going to occupy Toulon, he ordered that all incidents should be avoided. The Prime Minister, Mr. Churchill, may dwell on this event in the history of the war in a broadcast he will make to the world tomorrow evening, 9 o'clock London time. It will be the eve of his 68th birthday, and he will review the war's developments since his last direct broadcast, May 10th. Moscow radio this morning announced another striking success in the general offensive against the Germans. Soviet troops yesterday recaptured the important city of Kretskaya inside the Don Elbow. It was a city of the dead. Only 7 Russians were found wandering among the ruins. The rest of the population had been dragged into captivity by the retreating enemy or were massacred before the Germans left. The center of the town is one vast cemetery of German dead. The official Soviet communique this morning declared that since Thursday evening, not a single German soldier remains on the west bank of the Don in the 50-mile stretch which constitutes the Don Elbow. And now to Grant Parr in Cairo.
Hello, New York. This is Grant Parr speaking from Cairo, Egypt. Since June of 1940, one French battleship and 4 cruisers, besides numerous smaller craft, have been interned in Alexandria Harbor. The commander in charge, Admiral Godefroy, still maintains quarters on his flagship, but the majority of petty officers and seamen have been living ashore. They have received their regular pay and have had the freedom of the city. So far as I know, there's been no change in the situation of the French fleet at Alexandria, but events elsewhere have put the spotlight on it, for it is now the only French fleet afloat which is not under the control of the fighting French. Meanwhile, Marshal Rommel's troops went through the motion of digging in around the Gila, but the marshal, you can be very sure, was keeping one eye cocked in the direction of Tunisia, where the Allies were trying to split the Axis forces. By sitting down at a Gila, Rommel probably thinks that he serves a useful purpose. He prevents the Allies from rushing forward fighter aerodromes with which to protect a medium bomber shuttle service to Tripoli Harbor. Thus, he provides the Axis an extra chance as far as supply ports are concerned. To do this, he knowingly risks the complete destruction of his army. Rommel may have orders from Berlin to stage this sacrifice play, but a better guess is that he hopes to have his cake and eat it too. An old gag in warfare is to figuratively leave the campfires burning while your army is moving rapidly to other parts. The Germans quite possibly will wait until the 8th Army is ready for an all-out assault, and then, as quietly as possible, resume their retreat. They would figure that they thus gained time for their allies in Tripoli. The biggest obstacle to this scheme remains Rommel's old friends, the Allied Air Forces. They are not apt to let him retreat unscathed, and they are not likely to let Tripoli escape their bombs either. From Sicily to the Dodecanese, Allied bombers have pounded the Axis during the past 2 days and nights. Our pursuit shot down two enemy fighters south of Benghazi, and long-range fighters got a Junkers bomber south of Sicily. The most outstanding raid was an American operation. United States flying fortresses attacked floating dry docks on Lyra Island in the Dodecanese. It was the first raid ever carried out on that island. Two vessels were hit and set afire, and harbor installations and jetties damaged. I return you now to New York.
Next, we have a direct report from the Southwest Pacific Battlefront. Go ahead, Australia.
This is George Thomas Foster speaking from Australia. Politics has been the highlight of the week here in Australia. The spotlight has been in the form of a divided beam. One arc of the spotlight has been focused upon the Constitutional Convention at Canberra. The other has remained upon Prime Minister John Curtin's proposal to extend the territorial liabilities of the militia so that this branch of Australia's forces could go further afield in defense of the country. The proposed amendment to Australia's constitution is being sponsored by the Attorney General, Dr. Abbott. All week long, the convention has sat in the federal capital and around and argued the pros and cons of the radical bill. All sections of the country are, and should be, vitally interested in what the Attorney General has drafted as an amendment to the future way of life in Australia. However, just as we are prone to do at home, the average Australian man in the street is inclined to leave such matters to those he has elected to represent him in affairs governmental. Although this proposed changing of the Australian Constitution promises to alter his whole way of life after the war, I can honestly tell you that the average Australian has no idea of how far-reaching the plan is. This is not just snap judgment on my part. I have come to this conclusion after speaking to people in all walks of life in Australia's principal city. The parallel between Australia and our country goes even further. Only the war affair has been completely aired in the press, but again, Australians, like most Americans, are only headline readers. Just the contrary is true of the Prime Minister's plan to extend the sphere of operations of the AMS forces so that they can proceed outside of Australian territory and chase the Nips further along the seaways back towards Tokyo. This subject is very popular and is thoroughly discussed by just about everyone here. As things stand now, it looks as if the majority of the labor movement will line up behind the Prime Minister and that he will succeed in his motion. There may be trouble, however, because there is still one member of the ministry who is a dissenting voice. This is the Minister for Labor and National Services, Mr. Ward. Mr. Ward should be noted by the support of a certain militant section of the Labour Party, which has a powerful influence on labour affairs. This influence, in turn, and I have been told this by members of both factions, may finally cause a national government. This is George Thomas Foster, speaking from Australia.
And now for the latest news from the Russian front, we take you to Robert Magadoff in Moscow. Go ahead, Moscow. This is NBC New York calling Moscow. We regret that we are unable to contact our correspondent in Moscow this morning, Robert Magadoff. Here are a few dispatches from our New York newsroom. First, may we reiterate what Edward Deuce told you about Prime Minister Churchill's speech at 9 p.m. tomorrow night. That's London time. That's 4 p.m. Eastern wartime on Sunday. From Moscow, Marshal Timoshenko's Russian forces are scoring fresh gains in their violent offensive at Stalingrad. But there are increasing indications that the pace of the drive may have been slowed down to some extent. In an effort to prevent complete encirclement of some 300,000 Nazi troops in the beleaguered city, the Germans are said to have counterattacked in several areas with reinforced troops. But Moscow says these Nazi actions were repulsed and the Soviet lines themselves pushed forward. On the upper prong of the vast Russian pincers west of Stalingrad, another 1,000 enemy soldiers were killed during the night. And in the city itself, the strengthened defenders shoved the Germans out of 20 more blockhouses and recaptured several buildings. On the Leningrad front, the Russians say their artillery, scouts, and snipers have added another 1,000 to the Nazi toll of dead within the past few days. There is no direct mention, however, of a large offensive such as the Germans have been talking about on the front between Leningrad and Moscow. And here's a dispatch from Cairo. For the second day in a row, the British say there is nothing to report from the British 8th Army pursuing Rommel's forces in Libya. However, Allied warplanes have successfully bombed the Gherbini Airdrome in Sicily and Portolago Bay in the Dodecanese Islands. And over in the Orient, the Chinese may not have many weapons like planes and tanks, but they have another powerful weapon, resourcefulness. Resourcefulness of the type illustrated by this story revealed by the Chinese Information Ministry in Calcutta. On one side of a wide, impassable swamp was a Jap force. On the other side, a Chinese force. The Japs calmly went to bed that night, feeling secure. But the Chinese came riding water buffaloes, and they wiped out the Japs before the enemy knew what was happening. And now, here are the latest developments in our own capital, reported from the newsroom in Washington.
Official and unofficial Washington has lots to talk about this morning while awaiting the opening whistle of the Army-Navy game in nearby Annapolis. First of all, there's the persistent rumor that President Roosevelt is considering a major shakeup in his cabinet, a shakeup designed to help provide a solution to the knotty manpower problem. Washington observers, which of course can mean anybody living in the nation's capital for more than a year, have it that Harold Ickes will be shifted from the Interior to the Labor Secretaryship. Paul McNutt would take over Ickes' job as Secretary of Interior, while Madame Perkins would become Federal Security Administrator. Judge Rosenman of the New York Supreme Court and the President's close advisor arrived in Washington yesterday, and speculation has it that he has drafted the executive order necessary for such cabinet changes. On Capitol Hill, that group of congressmen opposing nationwide gasoline rationing has given up the fight to ban such a step, but now they're on the warpath, reaching for the scalp of Price Administrator Leon Henderson. Oil state legislators of the opposition bloc already have announced that they'll try to shove Henderson out of the federal picture by the appropriations route. Oklahoma Democrats Lyle Boren and Jed Johnson, two leaders of the House anti-Henderson movement, have as their battle cry, trillions for defense. But 15 cents for Leon Henderson is 15 cents too much. In direct contrast to this strident clamor, congressional leaders are sounding out sentiment in both houses on a proposal to adjourn Congress December 15th for the first formal holiday in 3 years. Both Democratic and Republican chieftains are in favor of a breathing spell before the new 78th Congress convenes January 4th. Back in the direction of the White House, there's talk this morning that the trip of Madame Chiang Kai-shek has a double purpose. One, to undergo medical treatment for an injury suffered during a Jap attack on Shanghai 5 years ago. Two, to discuss Pacific war strategy with the president. It's pointed out in Washington's tight little circle of wiseacres that the madam is not only the wife, but also the advisor of China's generalissimo. After receiving medical treatment, it's announced that Madame Kai-shek will be a guest at the White House, and it is presumed that she has with her messages from her husband concerning Allied operations in the Far East. Meanwhile, prospects appear brighter for a compromise solution to the controversy over civilian versus military control of war production. WPB Chief Donald Nelson and Secretary of War Stimson are said to have made good progress in 2 days of conferences. And that's all from the newsroom in Washington.
You have been listening to the latest news reported direct by our correspondents all over the world. We heard this morning from London, Cairo, Australia, and Washington. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station. This is the National Broadcasting Company.